Welcome to From the Heart with me, Dawn Lister, and my guest today, Karen Atkinson. Karen Atkinson is the CEO of Mindfulness UK, which some of our listeners will remember I did my mindfulness teacher training with. She's also the author of Compassionate Mindful Inquiry in Therapeutic Practice, a wonderful book that I have and is very well thumbed through. Karen is also a yoga teacher, a mindfulness trainer who works with individuals and companies. She is also a wife, a mother, and a very successful businesswoman and an all-round good egg. That's very British, isn't it? Good egg. I'm showing my age. Welcome, Karen. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you, Dawn. Yeah, really well. And you?
Yes, I'm very well. Thank you. All the better for sitting planning a few holidays today. Cheered me up no end. What's going on with this dreadful British weather? I can't bear it. There's not enough sun for my liking. So Karen has agreed to come back on the podcast after a wonderful conversation I had with myself and Daniel last time you came on about mindfulness and the benefits of mindfulness. And I think since that conversation, so much has happened in the world and happened to us all personally. And I thought it would be really interesting to chat to you and listen to some of your insights and wisdom and your very honest experiences about how it is for you and for your community and for your business in the world that we're living in now, and how you're using your practices and your wisdom to support you and kind of help you shape the way things are going forward. So maybe let's kick off with just sharing a little bit with us about how you are now and what's going on for you.
Yeah, I'm doing all right, thank you. Business is shifting and changing, which perhaps we'll dig deeper into in a little while. The sun is shining in the southwest. I'm going out on my bike in a bit, so I really enjoy that, and my garden is flourishing. So it's all good, and I have just come back from a really long holiday as well in Australia, which is where I was brought up. So I'm in a good place at the moment with all those things.
Sounds wonderful. I think it's very important to make sure we have breaks, isn't it? I think if you're privileged enough, which, you know, you and I both are very fortunate, we've been able to get little breaks here and there. Not everybody has the opportunity to get away, but even if it's just breaking from the normal activities of the day-to-day, which can become quite oppressive and challenging. The theme for this season is what does spirituality mean to you, and how do you access it in your life? Now, mindfulness can be something that we've spoken about in the past. It can seem a little dry, can't it? And I know you teach a beautiful model called the iceberg model, which I'd love you to chat about a bit more later. But also you always speak about in your practice when you're teaching about the importance of mindfulness being accompanied with compassion practices, compassion for yourself and for others. Uh-huh. Could you speak a little bit to that perhaps?
Yeah. I think when mindfulness courses were started to be taught by the great and the good, like John Kabat-Zinn and so on in the West, we were bringing mindfulness and compassion together. And I think the next generation of mindfulness teachers, and I think partly it was about the research, but also sort of the medical model that we operate in and the way society is, that mindfulness and compassion seemed to be separated somehow, and that there was so much more focus in on the mindfulness, and compassion was sort of left to the side and kept very much in the clinical realm with compassion focused therapy and so on, but it was still very underrated. And so I started teaching and training mindfulness with that strength of compassion running through it, and was seen as somebody who was really quite unusual in the field. And even now, you know, when I start to talk to people who were trained probably at the same time as me, but were trained within a sphere where mindfulness was heralded, and they can't quite understand why compassion is such an integral part of my teaching and the training and my life, really. A reason for that is for me that we talk about this two wings of the bird, and that one wing is mindfulness and one is compassion. And without having equal wings, then the bird's not going to fly well. And so for a lot of people, they're doing a lot of mindfulness practice and the compassion aspect isn't there. For some, a real minority, there's a lot of self-compassion, but there's not the wisdom that comes with mindfulness. And there's not that anchor, there's not the perspective taking that comes with mindfulness. So balancing out the two is what we need to do. And that is so, so powerful, and something that is sort of coming through a little bit more now. But I don't think we're there yet. I don't think people fully understand it. And I'm really excited about how compassion has been brought in more and more. But as I say, I think there's a lot more work to do to really balance it out.
That's a really beautiful explanation. Thank you. As you were first started speaking, my first thought was, when mindfulness started happening, there was a real push to do the research and develop data, wasn't there? Because our Western model, if we aren't able to prove it with data, then it doesn't hold value.
No.
And there's a lot to be said for clinical research. I'm not anti at all. I'm first person to say, show me a peer reviewed study before I believe in what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I want to know. Mm-hmm. But along with that, there's the experiential part of what's happening when you're doing a mindfulness practice. I think maybe I'm curious about what you feel. Why do you think so many people struggle with self-compassion? And your experience, what would you say that's about?
I think it's about a lot of different things. It's about our socialization, our culture. It's just not recognized that we need to look after ourselves. And I've heard over the many years that I've been teaching and training how stories of how, the girls got the and the children got the food at the end of the line. And actually, if there wasn't much food left, then, they just had to go without, and how it was a soft and that they shouldn't be worrying about themselves. It was egotistical, it was narcissistic, and so on. So I think that there's a lot in our culture which sort of says that self-compassion doesn't have any value, and that there's a real feeling that when we are self-compassionate, that there's a guilt there, maybe even some shame about. And I have conversations practically daily about, I don't know if I can do that, because it makes it look like I'm more important than the next person, or I'm placing myself up on a pedestal or something, and I don't want to be in that place. So guilt and shame and conditioning and socialization really contribute to this lack of self-compassion. And we're just not taught it. It's just starting to filter in, but really in schools, in workplaces, places we spend most of our time learning about ourselves and other people and how we relate, it's just not there yet. And there's still that kind of power of positive thinking aspect of, come on, you can do it. Like I think of it as a cheerleader, come on. And actually that it works short term, that I feel, but it's not that deep, nourishing place of really valuing ourselves, of being okay with, I'm here too, I'm important, as important as the next person, and because I place myself as important as having needs, it doesn't mean that I'm seeing anybody as less than me, as lower than me, or different to me. But why should I? Really, why should people see themselves as less as other people? It kind of doesn't equate to me. And in other societies, they don't have this struggle. It is very much a Western struggle, that's for sure.
That's interesting, isn't it? Other societies don't have that struggle. It's, maybe I wonder if perhaps in those societies the emphasis isn't on accumulation and productivity.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. They just live in different systems, and so wealth and you know, who's got what car and so on and so forth. You know, what we accumulate as human beings, it's just not got so much of an emphasis. I mean, I'm not saying people don't want to have good things in life, of course they do, but it's about where the emphasis lies, really. And I just think we're skewed, the society is skewed, and you know, that's a really, really big topic, isn't it? Like, is it political? There's lots and lots and lots of different reasons for it, but I think compassion, because it's seen as a touchy-feely indulgence, is not rated as being important. And I completely disagree with anybody who sees it like that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think when we see a lack of compassion in others or recognize it in ourselves, we can really see the damage that's done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things I learned over the years was I've probably one of the first practices I learned was the Metta Bhavan, which was compassion for others.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to turn that lens on myself.
Yeah, it's hard.
Very difficult, because
yeah.
I don't know what your feeling was, but I know once I started to do that, there was a lot of pain there about mm-hmm. the ways in which I hadn't shown myself compassion and the ways I was continuing to not show myself compassion. And then, as you said, the stories that sit alongside that around, you know, you're not more important than everybody else. You don't deserve to put yourself first. That's selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And unpicking some of that is huge, because you're unpicking perhaps your family story or your ancestral line
yeah.
or the story of the community that you live in and are invested in. Mm. So suddenly all of that's blown up, and now what do I do with that, and how do I navigate being compassionate to myself in a world where everybody else sees that as something to be what's the word I'm looking for, to be jeered at maybe, or
yeah.
down upon. So that was a real
yeah.
real challenge for me. Is that something you can relate to in any way?
Yeah, I think this sense of unworthiness is quite prevalent in our society. Who am I to be taking care of myself? And actually, we're actually quite good as human beings of taking care of other people. But in some ways, when I started to become much more self-compassionate, I felt that it was more authentic to be taking care of other people from a place of resourcefulness, I suppose, rather than depletion. Mm. So for me, compassion just helps me to take good care of myself enough to be able to look after other people. And it had a kind of a positive feedback mechanism, if you like, where I started to feel more worthy.
Mm.
So I did deserve some kindness and care. And I started to reach out. If I needed help, I reached out for some help. Whereas when I was in a place of feeling really unworthy and shame and guilt about it, I felt very, very alone and isolated in that, and that I was the one that was suffering the most. And I didn't want to bother anybody else. I didn't want to cause any waves or ripples in anybody else's life with my rubbish, you know. And now I recognize that actually it's okay for me to go through difficult times and to reach out. And it doesn't mean that I'm needy or demanding or anything like that. It's just we all need support, and we're all connected and interconnected, and it's okay to sometimes be giving and sometimes be receiving, and to have an open heart about that. And not feel like I'm being manipulative or doing it for any other reason than I deserve to have some support sometimes.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I think for some people who are listening along, they'll be sitting nodding and saying, oh yeah, that's kind of obvious. And then for other people, it'll be a revelation. Mm-hmm. And there may be some stuff coming up as you're listening to it that you're thinking, oh my God, that's making me feel a bit uncomfortable. And I would say, if that is what's happening for you now as you listen, then take some time to really sit with that and be compassionate with yourself, you know, be gentle with that part of you, and kind of, and I like the language you always use, is, you know, be curious. Curious about, well, what's that about, and where did I learn that, and, you know, what sits underneath that, and what would happen if I were to try something different, what might that look like, and what's my fear around that. And there's so much gold to be excavated, isn't there, inquiring.
Yeah,
which is kind of a lot of what your book's about. Could you say a little bit about your book and kind of why you wrote it, and why I know why it's so useful, but you're much more eloquent in saying why it would be useful for our readers, for our listeners, perhaps.
Yeah. So, as you heard at the beginning, I do a lot of training and teacher training in mindfulness and compassion. And I was hearing over and over again about how the emphasis was on mindfulness, and that there just wasn't the literature out there that kind of interrelated the two, that was in a secular setting. There's a lot of Buddhist and other religious work out there that absolutely interweaves the two. And I felt that I wanted to develop a model that would help people to really understand it much more clearly, that interrelationship between mindfulness and compassion. The role of awareness, the role of becoming conscious, of waking up and seeing things in reality. So the model's got sort of six different processes to it, starting with the building of awareness, just that noticing, observing, recognizing what's here, and then starting to be curious about it. Second process is about noticing what's happening and starting to investigate patterns and perhaps why we're doing things, as you've just said. And that for me is we're starting already to get into a therapeutic realm. It's not a therapy, but starting to kind of investigate that for ourselves, and then linking the two, where we integrate that learning about becoming aware and noticing what happens, but also how we can take that out into our everyday life, so that whatever happens for us in our meditation practice, we're bringing our everyday life into that. And then whatever we learn from our practice, sometimes we can really take that out into our everyday life. So the model is very much about inquiring, self-inquiry, and working with the inquiry process with others. So we get to that third process where we can really acknowledge what's here. We can be able to see, to observe, to touch into our reality. But for some people, that's a very difficult place to be. They can see that they think like they do, they behave like they do because of difficult circumstances, or that they've been driven by impulses and there's a lack of awareness. But often that's where mindfulness teachers stop and say, well, it's really helpful to sit with that. Sit with that discomfort, sit with that unease or that vulnerability. And I don't disagree with that, but it's not the full answer. So for me, there's a fourth process that comes in. So it's going down and around the iceberg, where we can bring in some self-soothing, some self-kindness to what's there. You know, it's not our fault that our physiology drives us to do lots of different things. It's not our fault that we've got patterns of behavior that perhaps really protected us and looked after us as we were children and growing up. And they served their purpose. But now, as grown-ups, maybe it's so deeply ingrained and we haven't shone a light on it, and it doesn't serve us anymore. Mm-hmm. So if we start to bring in our kindness and maybe have an internal dialogue that's quite different, and start to actually do some practices that focus on soothing. So soothing touch, hugging, and also just dropping in time and time again about, how can I be kinder to myself in this moment? Every time we bring our mindfulness or mindful awareness to something, cutting through autopilot, rather than just noticing, we can ask ourselves that question, how can I be kinder to myself in this moment? And it might just be having a sip of water, having a wriggle of your toes, a stretch, a deeper breath, whatever. And then as we start to put this into practice more and more, we become more self-compassionate, which is squirmy and challenging for some and really difficult, it slowly starts to create some brain changes, which helps it to settle and become more familiar. You know, it's called practice for a reason. We practice our mindfulness, we practice our self-compassion. And then, like I said earlier, the more self-compassionate you become, the more you can authentically really look after other people in a way that you feel resourced. And so, yeah, that's they're the six processes. But for me, I developed a cyclical process so that as we start to see that we can be more self-compassionate on one level, we can go back into being mindful about, oh, I've seen that pattern and I still can support myself in that, but I'm sure there's more here. Let's just keep on familiarizing ourselves with ourselves, connecting with what's here for us, how we feel, how we can look after ourselves as external events change, as internal events change. So yeah, it's an ongoing process, which to me is beautiful. And that's where my curiosity comes, because it's actually never ending. I never think, oh, once I've got to that end process, then I'm finished, I'm done and dusted, and I can stop my practice or whatever. It's ongoing and I love it. Yeah.
Thank you for that explanation. It's really beautiful. I would really recommend the book to anyone who's interested in maybe understanding self-compassion a little bit more, or more mindfulness, but not just teachers and practitioners.
Yeah. Now
I know some of the people I've worked with over the years who particularly when we've done, you know, the MBSR, the 8-week course, who wanted to go away and develop their self-compassion practices, I've recommended the book to them. They found it quite helpful. Because it felt like such a revelation. You know, that whole idea of when you feel your suffering, when you finally recognize there's my suffering, I see it, I feel it, it's tangible to me. You're not just avoiding it anymore, you're sitting in it. To actually then turn your attention very gently and kindly towards it is profound. And in fact, that's what I was teaching on retreat last weekend, turning towards our pain. I thought of you many times, turning towards our pain over and over again. And knowing also, which was really lovely to hold, is like, you can just glance and look away.
Yeah.
You don't have to stay there in that stress. You know, if you don't feel resourced, you can step away. And I think maybe let's talk a little bit about that for a minute. You know, that was quite a big part of the retreat last weekend, was if you're not resourced, you can't do any of this anyway. And you maybe don't realize you're not resourced because you've been on autopilot for such a long time that you're living on fumes. And so, you know, I think that for me is a huge part of what mindfulness practice with self-compassion has done for me over the years, is like taught me to have that daily check-in and sometimes that hourly check-in at more challenging times, or moment-to-moment check-in. And if I can start to feel that I'm getting depleted, I know what that looks like. And now, because I know what that will look like for me, and it'll be different for other people, I know, okay, I'm going to get to a place where I'm not resourced. So these are the things I need to put in place. I mean, is there anything you'd like to speak to about that resourcing piece?
Yeah, I think that it's very individual, and that there is some work to be done around supporting people to really tap into what it is that they need to be resourced. And again, in our society, we're always looking at what other people are doing and thinking, oh, I must do that marathon and I should be like that, and so on and so forth. And actually, when we start to familiarize ourselves with ourselves, it opens the door to what we need. And I found that was an extraordinary part of the process. And actually, I'm still in that process, because my needs were not met as I was growing up. And again, it's not something that in this society you're asked very often, well, what are your needs? So as I open the doors to my needs and I meet them with kindness, it helps to really resource me. The mindfulness aspect of it is very, very important, in that it steadies, it provides an anchor, it helps you to kind of step back sometimes to see things in perspective, rather than kind of getting sucked into a vortex of either our own difficulties or that of, you know, the energies of people around us and so on. So the mindfulness part is such an important aspect that enables me to see, like you just said, whether I am actually resourced to go in there or not today. And then with that, tapping into needs, well, what do I need right now? And it, often for me, it's outdoor space, movement. You know, I started this formally as a yoga teacher. I mean, I had different practices even before that and different ways of coping with difficulties before that. But yeah, me doing movement practice, a physical practice of just hand on the heart, talking internally to myself with real tones of endearment, you know, it's okay that you're suffering like this. I can feel your pain and I know where it comes from and what is it you need right now to really take good care of yourself. And I have that internal dialogue rather than, oh, which I have, this is what I had before. For goodness sake, you should be able to sort this out. You know, you're young and you're fit and you do your mindfulness practice and yeah, you know what you're supposed to do, so just get on with it. And I have completely different dialogue now that I've learned about that relationship between mindfulness and compassion really deeply.
Thank you. I wonder if you could touch on, you have a personal journey of coming through cancer, and I imagine that was quite a turning point for you, learning turn towards yourself. Would you be happy to chat a little bit about that?
So it's a tender conversation to have, but I'm sort of 10 years nearly 10 years post having cancer, and it has taken me this long to really talk about it, to be honest, and what happened to me. I had my mindfulness practice, I had my yoga practice, which is kindly, but it was also because I was internally quite a competitive person. I was competing against myself and wanting to stretch more, you know, strengthen and all the rest of it. And then completely out of the blue. And I know cancer does come out of the blue, but it was for me. I just had a very small investigation, was told I didn't have cancer, and I thought, I never even crossed my mind that I did. The procedure was over and done with, and I just got back on with my life thinking it was all okay. And a few weeks later I had a phone call in the evening to say, you know, I'm really sorry to have to say, and, you know, then it transpired that I had cancer, and that it was so unusual in somebody of my age. They used the word aggressive, and I think that they were blown away by it themselves. And they told me that at 6:30 in the evening, and I was in an appointment at 8:30 the following morning with the NHS. So, and it was just extraordinary. So it just happened so quickly. And you know, anybody who has been through this process or cared for somebody in this process, it's a whirlwind, an absolute whirlwind. And I thought, you know, I was on the treadmill of investigations and operations and so on and so forth, but all the time I thought, oh, I've got my practice to keep me stable and steady. And I just remember one evening in the sunshine in my practice space, just really, really crying so much, thinking, I can see the reality of this. I don't know if I'm going to survive or not. That is the reality. And that's absolutely true. And how devastating that was 10 years ago. I was in my late 40s. And, you know, and my children and my husband, and just thinking, this, my practice, this isn't enough to sustain me. Mm-hmm. And so I was very fortunate that I could ask some people within my Sangha, my community, about how to work with this distress, this deep suffering. Because when you shine a light on your suffering, it can be overwhelmingly painful. And so people, you know, one person in particular said, well, you just need to be kind to yourself. And I know we say that a lot, but it was like, well, how do I do that? And so I bought every book I could possibly find on self-compassion. Tara Brach, Kristen Neff, Sharon Salzberg, Christopher Germer, all the big names. And I started doing the practice, and it was awful, as in I found it so, so hard to do self-compassion practices at the beginning. And I it was very challenging, but I thought, I've got to keep going with this. And so it started to shift, small, small changes along the way. And I started to notice that things were differing for me internally about how I looked after myself before I went to see my consultants. I made sure that I had some space after having appointments before kind of getting in the car and going home and going back to work or whatever it was. I created time for me to process as best I could in that whole scheme of things. And all of these little things that I did started to build me up. There's no question about it. I started to feel, oh, this is different. And I looked internally at my patterns and recognized, yes, the competitive nature. Come on, you should do better. Get through this. People are, you know, not even crying with cancer, and here I am in floods of tears. And where's my get up and go? And actually allowing myself to feel the pain of it, and really opening my heart to it. And that was when I started to heal, when I really started to allow myself to feel that and to bring in this other way of being with myself internally, but also externally. So I looked at my relationships and thought, well, is that relationship serving me well? How have they been for me or not for me during this time of real massive distress? When you think people, when the, something hits the flat fan, they're going to be there, and they're actually not. So I had a really big look at that, and that was painful as well, letting go. But ultimately, it served me well to enable me the space to heal, to surround myself with beautiful people, you included, Dawn, who really supported me. And I'm changed forever because I still have physical kind of pain and difficulty. I have some emotional and psychological stuff that comes up for me, but equally and opposite, I have much more joy, much more gratitude, so much kindness and care in my life from myself and actually from other people, because I'm being authentic and I'm much more comfortable, I think, with my suffering and the suffering of others, and not trying to fix things, and just allowing myself to be with how it is, not trying to rush things or push things, and seeing all of that as acts of kindness, to put it into context, I think. So enabling me to do a practice while I'm watching my breath and seeing, oh, that's a real act of self-kindness. To pick the practice that I need right now, a movement practice, even though I should be doing a different practice because I'm reading a book or watching a podcast or whatever. But actually, what I feel like I need is a movement practice or a yoga practice of yoga nidra or something like that. Mm-hmm. And being okay with myself around that, which I never would have been pre-cancer, never. So yeah, it's opened up a world of opportunity, and I'm not saying that I would want anybody to go through it, and that, but it was a pivotal moment in my life, and I do see my life as pre-cancer and post-cancer, definitely. Yeah. Mm.
Gosh, that's really profound to listen to there. You use the words that are coming to me is you use the cancer as our opportunity to excavate.
Mm.
A real deep dive, wasn't there, into how you hold yourself,
mm-hmm.
and how the structures around you support you, like,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not saying this is what you did, but I think sometimes in our lives we abandon ourselves a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we've been shown, that's what was modeled to us maybe in childhood, mm-hmm. or it's modeled to us in the world around us, which is, if you look out at the general population, the people maybe that are admired or admired for something that actually isn't very admirable. It might be an accumulation of wealth or status or fame, or you know, or they're very, you know, almost a bit martyry or something. And actually, yeah, person is really well rounded with healthy boundaries and a lot of balance. You don't hear a lot about those people, do you?
No, that's true.
They're not somebody that people are shining a light on particularly. And perhaps in our own family story, that's, you know, certainly in our family story, you were never supposed to put yourself first.
No.
I just, you know, I mean, I remember one of my earliest memories of Bible teachings, we were brought up very Christian, was, you know, the Good Samaritan, and, you know, never taking the biggest slice of cake and never having the best seat at the table. It's like, you should give, you always give up. You give up everything. That's the only way to salvation. You give up everything, like this rule of renunciation. And you, I kind of look back and think, God, for so many years I renounced just this, any sense of who I was. And that can be very challenging to try to bring in a different way of being with yourself and being in relationship with yourself. And it sounds like for you, and I think this does happen for many people actually, once you have a big health scare, and it doesn't always have to be a health scare, it could be a financial scare or something else, it makes you reassess, doesn't it, the way you are in the world.
Yeah, it really does. And I think another aspect was that I kind of let go of conventionality and what I was supposed to be like, because I'd questioned so much about how I'd been molded and shaped and developed. And it kind of, when I realized actually that that's no good for me anymore, it allowed me to let go to such a level that I was able to tap into other things that really feed and sustain me, that I had always been a part of, but then this convention or conventionality kind of kicked in and thought, oh, I won't dabble in that at the moment because I've got a business to run, or I've got work to do, and I shouldn't be like that, you know. And now I feel very connected to so many things that I didn't allow myself to be connected to before. And I try things out that I never would have done. I go to groups that I never would have gone to. And, you know, there's it's just opened up so many possibilities and is nourishing for me. So, yeah, it has changed my life incredibly. And I think it's just allowed me to be really authentic.
Which is that was the word that came to me as you were talking. I think being authentic is everything to me. I can't not be authentic. The distress is too great, and if I'm in a situation where showing up as myself isn't safe, take a toll. And there are situations, let's be honest, where you're in that place. You can't avoid it in the world we're living in. It's not going to be the healthiest thing for you to just show up telling your truth or living so therefore you have to kind of go, for this hour, for this day, I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to hold back. I'm going to keep my, and but then I need to rest. Like that's the thing that will happen for me. I'll need to go and maybe swim will do me the world of good, or lift some weights, because that physicality for me is actually better than my yoga practice. That feels more sustaining. My yoga practice for me is much more about nidra and breath. That's the bit that I take away. And then I need rest. I'm like, my nervous system's shattered from hiding.
Absolutely. But for me, it's a choice. And I think that that's what's empowered me, is that I see I'm going to choose to step into this space right now, because that's what convention dictates, or what society requires of me, and this is how I'm going to be and present myself. And I'm not saying that I'm going against myself. It's just a part of me that I step into that space, and I've chosen to do that rather than being feeling like I was being pushed or squeezed or, you know, shoehorned or whatever. And then I can say, yeah, so I've done that now, and now what do I need to restore or to rebalance? And I think we all do that to a point. We've got different hats we wear, and you know, at work we're different to when we're with certain friends and you know others, and it's okay. But when it comes from a place of feeling that you're really making a choice from the heart about how you're going to be, that is so empowering. Yeah, and that's a huge thing I've learned in this. Yeah, so I don't feel forced or that people have to cajole me or anything anymore. I just either choose to step in or I choose to step away.
That sounds very empowering. Very empowering. I mean, just, I don't want to go too deep dive into this, but just, you know, you spoke about that kind of like finding your authentic self.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit curious about that. I think, you know, we all have a self that is inherent within us, which when I tap into that place, all I feel there is compassion. That is the only feeling that is present in that space. And I very much dip in and out of that, you know, because as you said, you can't, that isn't the world we live in. You know, we aren't living in a space where it's safe to always be exactly how we'd want to be. Can you, I mean, I know that when I first kind of really felt that properly, I was probably in my 40s actually, where I really, really embodied it. And that was, that just certainly changed my life. And it changed, you know, like the whole idea of why I was in the world changed. There wasn't striving stopped. That's the thing that stopped for me, was this striving. That's not to say that I don't get pulled back into it from time to time, but I quite quickly notice I'm going into a strivey space. And then I'll sit down and reflect. I'm like, what am I striving for? What's this really about? What's the lack? Who am I doing it for? And then sometimes it can be helpful to stay there for a little bit because you maybe got something you want to achieve. But, you know, I have to come back to that. If it doesn't feel like it's nourishing me and my compassion and then the others around me, I can't be there for very long. And for me, that's my spirituality, that returning home to that seat of compassion, which just feels so beautiful and expansive and peaceful. Can you say a little bit about what that looks like for you?
Yeah. I mean, all of this is around my spirituality, and that compassion has really helped, the self-compassion. I mean, I was a nurse, so I was compassionate to others, but the self-compassion has enabled me to drop into a space that is, it absolutely is my heart space, but that heart space, sometimes it feels like it's for me, but other times it feels universal, and as in as big as the universe and beyond. And I feel like I'm so connected to things when I'm in my practice that it really helps me to shed the all that external noise, really, and to be at one with things as they truly are, so to find that truth and that allowing, it really has been an opening of a door through self-compassion to that place of being able to be interconnected. And you know, I have read a lot about quantum physics and universal consciousness and so on, and I you know, I'm not that eloquent about talking about it, but I really sense into it, and I truly believe that there's so much that goes on and so much that connects us all, and that helps me to feel very at peace with who I am and where I am, and the gratitude that I feel for being so fortunate to have survived and to have been given the care, be in a society that gave me the care that they did to enable that to happen. That kind of it flows into this pool of consciousness as well, that means that I don't get so caught up in the Western worries, and I can see the impermanence and feel into that flow like I never really did in this way before.
Thank you for that. I think that's a great word, isn't it? Remembering the impermanence. It's certainly something I use as a daily practice when there's distress, as well as attending to it in whatever way I feel I have the capacity to do, whether it's in that moment or later. I also will remind myself to take a step back and back and back and back until I'm far enough back to remember this will change.
Yeah. It
always changes. And sometimes the most painful thing is the thing that you need right now to get you to the next to place you need to be.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah. That and turning to our suffering helps us to really identify what our fear is. And when we can really align ourselves with that fear, what is your fear? And my fear was dying, leaving my children, leaving my husband, not finishing off what I'd set out to do, whatever that was, because I was striving and competitive at the time. You know, there was a massive fear there. And I would say that fear is really diminished through the self-compassion, through being kinder and being having that sense of interconnectedness and impermanence. And yeah, there's so much there, so much a feeling of being able to touch into something else that's not all about me. And that's just so resourcing and really buoys me up.
I mean, I think, and again, let's not go too heavy into this, but just the idea of the ego, you know, I don't like this, like, let's get rid of our ego. We need an ego to be in a human body and in a human situation.
Yeah.
But remember, there's more than our ego. There's more than that. There's that view. We speak about it as the observer or the viewer. And that to remember, you know, when we're very stuck in our pain, that actually, if I step back, and for me, it is almost like a tangible feeling of removing myself backwards, not disassociation, which is different. No. It's very much, I'm still here and I'm taking a wider view. And then you tap into all the other stuff that's happening around you, has happened before and is still to come. And, you know, as you spoke about, your connectedness with everything around us, you know, the planet, other human beings, sentient beings, you know, the whole universe, that stuff is very, it feels, well, deeply resourcing, but also it feels in some levels to me more real than being in the ego state.
Absolutely. Completely. Yeah. Yeah. I really, really agree with that. And it helps me to be more compassionate as well to other people when you've had an opportunity to step back and to see their suffering. They're coming with their own stuff going on, and you know, it's not their fault either. So instead of being kind of all knotted up with she said this and he said that and, you know, that's not fair and all of that, just to take it back and see, oh, that's how that's playing out, and that's okay, you know, and I'm not going to be pulled in quite so much as I would have been before. It's not to say that you don't get hurt, that you don't suffer, but there's a spaciousness about it, and a knowing that you can look after yourself within that suffering that I never knew was there for me before I developed self-compassion.
Yeah. If I were to ask you, well, two things. First thing being, if somebody's listening to this and they perhaps have had a diagnosis of cancer or in a situation where they're, you know, having treatment, or they've got a family member or a loved one who is going through that, what would be your main piece of advice to them from your reflective place?
I think one of the main things I really learned through the process that was related to self-compassion is that you can't rush this process, and that when you're going through cancer treatment and recovery or wherever you are with your cancer diagnosis, you can't think your way out of it, and it takes time to connect what's going on. It's so, for me, it might not be for other people, but for me it was such a shock to my system that my head, heart and body took a long time to reconnect. And the only way that I felt that I could do that was through acts of kindness, and that would take time. And I can't just say, well, if I do this 10 times, I'm going to start to feel better, or for 10 weeks, I'm going to feel better. So I think an act of kindness is to really give yourself space and time to be however you need to be in this. And if I mean, I've said it before, if an act of kindness is running a marathon, or if it is, you know, doing something else, joining a charity that really contributes back in, and whatever, they're all wonderful ways of taking care of yourself. You're tapping into your own needs and what you need to do and to give to yourself and to give back. But don't rush it and look externally, look internally, be kind to yourself around that, and give yourself time and space to allow yourself to rebalance and heal in whichever way that manifests for you.
Thank you. And then the other question, I'm not asking you huge existential questions, I totally am. The other question is, you know, in the world that we're living in now, post-COVID world, the world that's really in quite a lot of turmoil across the world, we look at the environment, we look at the wars that are happening, the economy, you know, systems clearly breaking down. And yet what I witness as I sit from a place of observing, hopefully from compassion, not always, but I try, you know, people clinging on. Because as things start to break down, they hang on tighter. It's like the Titanic, swim away, don't hang on to the side. I can't see, you know, these great big companies and, you know, individuals and just trying desperately to make things fit when they're clearly breaking apart. Like this feels quite painful to watch. I've personally had to make lots of personal changes in business and personal life to accommodate the changing nature of our world that we're living in, so that I feel I'm living in a resourced and compassionate place. I'm quite comfortable with it. It's not to say there's not some tiredness and distress, because it's exhausting to change. But I'm happy with it. But what would your advice be? Because we're not going to be the only people who are feeling that way right now.
No. It reminds me of my teacher, who was talking once to me about where we are in the world. And he was saying that when a caterpillar builds a cocoon around themselves, what happens to the caterpillar is it completely, the cells sort of disintegrate in some ways, and they have to, within the cocoon there's like a mush and then that mush realigns itself to make itself into a butterfly, and when the butterfly is ready it comes out of the cocoon. And I think that it's such a lovely way of viewing where we are. We're in that mushy place where I honestly believe that things are having to reconfigure themselves, to realign and come out in a different way. And we talk about paradigm shift or whatever it is, but we need to get into the mush to be able to let go of old habits, old patterns, old ways of being, to be able to come back together and come out like a butterfly. And I have no idea of how long we have to be in this mushy place for, but it's helped me to see that this is an impermanent place as well, and that all we can do when we're in this place of change and dysfunctionality is to be aware that we're not alone, and that everybody else is experiencing it to a greater or lesser extent, and that the only thing around that we can actively do is to look after ourselves. We can look after ourselves internally, and we can look after each other. And so if we bring in self-compassion and compassion for others in such a genuine way amongst the turmoil, amongst the change and the impermanence, then that enables us to be able to navigate our way through. Well, it certainly does for me anyway, and for a lot of the people that I teach. As I start, you know, I see that people have shorter fuses, thinner skins, whatever the expressions are. And it's inevitable. We've all been through this global trauma, and we need to find a way through it. And as, again, time will enable this to happen, we can't force it. We just need to take care of ourselves and each other in that genuine, heartfelt way.
Thank you. It feels like you spoke about a paradigm shift. It feels like we need to move from the capitalist accumulation model of achieving things to make us feel better to a model which is about connection.
Definitely. Yeah.
And I think on lots of levels, people kind of already know that.
Of course.
But there's a certain comfort in what you already are used to doing.
Completely.
So letting go of the idea of I need to accumulate X, Y, and Z to feel safe is quite a big thing to do. So, you know, my reflection on, I agree with everything you said. And I would also add, you know, we still, as we start to wake up to that fact, he's like, you're going to feel some pain around that.
Oh, because absolutely.
You might even start feel some shame. You know, you look back, you think, oh my God, I did, look at what I've been doing and look what my family's done and look what generations of my ancestors have done. And it's, you know, I don't know that shame is very helpful. I don't think it's helpful, but it's something that I think does come up. Mm-hmm. And like, just stay with that kindness towards yourself. And the more we're gentle with ourselves, then the easier it is to kind of make connections from that place. If you're in a kind space, as you've spoken about, that's how you meet people, with from that energy, and that's how they can then interact with you. And with kindness, we can build a new world, a new paradigm, even if it's just within our family structure as a starting place.
And it gives us a platform from which to make choices. So it doesn't mean that we're passive in any way, which is a lot of people think it's about turning the other cheek, and yes, to an extent it is, but I feel quite activated through the compassion that I feel for my fellow human beings, for the planet, you know, for nature. And it leads me to a place of activism rather than of passivism. and that feels really congruent. So it gives me the compassion that I feel, gives me the energy to be able to feel, what can I do to support other humans, nature, our planet, and that won't deplete me to such an extent that I will be no good to anybody. And so that coming from that place gives me a possibility to contribute to the change. And that I find that so invigorating to be in that place, and that really drives me.
Thank you, Karen. As always, it's been wonderful to chat with you. Is there anything you would like to share or let people know how they can get a hold of you or work with you or practice with you as we come to a close?
Oh, thank you. So, if you would like to practice with us, mindfulnessuk.com. We do have a membership to our community. There's a free membership, really recognising that people are not necessarily able to afford to be full members, but you can be full member as well. And we have so many talks and book clubs and practice sessions and one thing and another. So please just have a look at our website and you'll be welcome with open arms.
And I would thank you. And I'd also recommend, you know, for companies maybe that are leaning in towards looking after their staff a bit better, Karen does some wonderful, and her company does some wonderful things in-house to help you support your staff and your community. So that's always worth reaching out and looking at what she could offer. Thank you so much for your time today, and thank you to our lovely listeners for listening. Please do the thing, go to the old star button or whatever it is and leave us a little review and a comment. I'd love to hear your thoughts around self-compassion and, you know, what you felt about this podcast or ways that you practice compassion yourself, or any questions that you might have for Karen, because I'm sure she'll come back and talk to us again. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being with us. Please take care of yourself. It all starts with you after all.
Thank you, Dawn.